And for a parent to be able to verbalize that to a teen is then, you know, teaching healthier coping, healthier understanding, so that they don't have to live in that shame and they're more likely to kind of take risks and do new things and take care of themselves.
Are you raising a family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. I'm so grateful that within the last few years, neurodivergence with children, teens, and even adults has become more widely discussed and more accepted than ever before. Listeners of the show know that we've tackled ADHD, autism, and mental health in previous episodes, but we've never gotten the chance to discuss the specifics of how neurodivergent teens fit into the family unit as a whole. I'm excited to chat with our guest today about how parents can prioritize stability and support for their teen, and also learn strategies for increased executive functioning and emotional regulation for both their teen and themselves. How can parents process their own emotional ups and downs while navigating neurodivergence? How can they reduce shame in themselves and in their teen? What about the impact on the other kids or extended family members? To answer these questions, we've brought on Sarah Morellis with over 10 years of experience working with neurodivergent teens, children, and families. Sarah now trains parents of teenagers with autism, ADHD, OCD, and more. Sarah, welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all the work you do to educate community members, families, to just help these kiddos more. So I just really appreciate all the work you're doing, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That means a lot to me. First, I was thinking about this when I was preparing to have this wonderful conversation. I'd love for you to describe in your own words what neurodivergence means, just so that our listeners are all on the same page. Even this morning, I was telling someone about the discussion we're about to have, and they said, "What is neurodivergence?"
Yeah, absolutely. So neurodivergence can mean a lot of different things, but to me, it means any type of brain functioning or individual that might have brain chemistry, brain functioning that might work a little bit differently than what's deemed typical. And there are, in clinical language, I'm trying not to use too much clinical language, but there's a lot of diagnosis or, you know, types of individuals with certain diagnosis that would be deemed atypical. So that might look like ADHD, autism, even anxiety, OCD, and then you might have communication disorders like dyslexia and processing disorders as well. But really, it's just, in my opinion, we're all a little bit neurodivergent. We're all on the spectrum of everything where we might think about or do things a little bit differently. And so that's just what it means to me. You know, what we're processing and taking in the world a little bit differently than what's deemed average.
I like neurodivergence as a way to describe someone instead of saying atypical. It's a much more sensitive way to say it. And I'm curious, can you become neurodivergent or are you just born with it?
That is a really great question. So
it's complicated, I know.
Yeah, it's complicated. For the most part, right, there's a genetic component. There's a, you know, you're kind of born with it. And a lot of times it kind of shows more over time as you age. I know for ADHD especially, especially in women, it kind of really presents itself or kind of worsens as you get older. But then you might get something like a traumatic brain injury that might happen later in life. And if you're already neurodivergent, it could like proliferate kind of the signs and the symptoms. So the answer is both. Yeah.
I would agree. I really do. I would love to hear about your day-to-day work with parents of neurodivergent teens. How much work do you do with parents versus the teens themselves?
So I do, I'd say it's about 50-50. I do both. You can't involve a teen or a kiddo in treatment without involving the parent, because, you know, they're with maybe their therapist 1 hour a day, but they're with their parent the other 167 hours of the day.
Right.
So you really need both parties' involvement, so that, right, you're not only teaching the teen skills, but you're also teaching the parent the skills to be able to implement that at home and really change the culture so that everybody's on the same page and learning and growing together. So it's about 50-50, honestly, right? I'll do a 1 hour individual session with the teen if I'm working with both, and then another hour devoted to parents and skills coaching.
So. I love that you involve the parents. On your website, Sarah, you mentioned that you assist parents of neurodivergent teens eliminate unhealthy behavior patterns. Can you give us some examples of those patterns?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great question. So usually when I'm working with a neurodivergent teen, there may be a presence of severe anxiety or sometimes OCD. A lot of times there's a lot of overlap with autism, and sometimes the presence of what we call pathological demand avoidance, which is commonly occurring with autism. And so there might be a lot of rigidity in the way that they do things or kind of engage in day-to-day habits. So there might be a little bit more willfulness to engage in new behavior, trying new things. When you're talking about like unhelpful behavior patterns, I'm really talking about more of being in such a rigid or fixed mindset where they're really not open to learning anything new. So that might be, and not always the case, but I think parents often struggle with like, my kid won't do anything. They'll shut down or they'll get mad at me. So that might be like kind of open to doing things like hygiene, right? So brushing teeth, taking a shower, that might also look like, you know, helping out around the house or engaging in homework. But it's less about, I mean, it is the behavior, but it's also about the mindset about what it means to engage in that behavior that we're really looking at and trying to help with.
Yes, like what's behind the behavior that we really need to look at versus the actual behavior itself. Like, why are they doing or being resistant, for example?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Do you have any memories of especially powerful transformations that you've seen parents and families go through thanks to your coaching?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so many. a big one that comes to mind. Again, we're talking about like teeth brushing or initiating tasks around hygiene. There was a case, right, where their teen, right, because of the kind of the over control and the demand avoidance and the fear, like just the overwhelm, right? When we deal with the kind of like the autism, sometimes burnout from so many demands being placed, that it can feel so overwhelming that the teen might kind of shut down. One of the teens was kind of experiencing that psychological burnout. And so they were kind of just staying in their room. They weren't taking care of hygiene, like brushing teeth or showering. Mm-hmm. They weren't really socializing or kind of just open to, you know, spending time with family. So, you know, we start with just the very basics, the foundation of self-care, right? You can't do everything at once. I know parents experience a lot of shame around what their kid can and can't do because there's a lot of pressure to be typical. But with this teen, you know, we're starting with the basics of brushing teeth. So we kind of have to think outside of the box and think of, okay, I'm not trying to get my teen to be typical. I'm just trying to get a system that works for my teen. So we did a technique where we instead of the teen going to brush their teeth, we made the access point easier. Mm-hmm. So we tried a lot of different things that might have been, we're having a different toothbrush in all the different rooms of the house. So they wouldn't have to go to it, right? It would be there.
Okay.
once a day, a parent would like knock on the door and check in and be like, hey, I brought a toothbrush and a cup. Like, how are we feeling today? Mm-hmm. Right. And not forcing it, but giving it as the option. But that being brought, sometimes accommodation can be helpful with burnout. So they would kind of decide yes or no. We played with it, what it means to actually brush your teeth, right? It could have been chewing gum or like using a toothpick, or they have kind of those alternative toothbrushes, right? Like a toothpick. But we found that system of like the parent just knocking in and checking in once a day. So eventually the teen started like taking more initiative with it, and like decide when it was there deciding to brush their teeth, you know, slowly building that kind of structure. Okay, they're doing it once a week, twice a week, and even too with the shower, right? Making the access point easier. So a lot of times we view accommodation as a bad thing, but when there's burnout, you know, so
I would agree 100%.
Yeah, so the parent would turn on the water, they'd get the towel, and then the teen would just do the rest. So there was less of a overwhelm in thinking all the different steps. Because sometimes with neurodivergence too, there's kind of like memory impairments, especially when there's like emotional overwhelm. Sometimes the idea of all of the different steps would lead the teen to kind of shut down and not initiate. But if you break it down into small, like 5-minute increments, or we just have to do this one step, right? We're just washing our hair and then we're getting out.
I have to share a story about my own son, mm-hmm. who really resisted taking showers. So I think this advice can really go for any child or any parent who's struggling to get their child to do some of these basic hygiene. So really appreciate you sharing it. But we used to do the 90-second shower. And what I mean by that is I was like, you only have to be in there for 90 seconds, you know, and this is what we're going to get done in the 90 seconds. He's an adult male now, and we still joke about the 90-second shower, but it was really effective. When I spelled it out for him that it's just going to be 90 seconds, he was willing and able to have that flexibility. And that kind of gets into my next question is, I really want to get deeper in the nitty-gritty of what these transformations for families might look like. You mentioned mental flexibility and emotional regulation in your work. Can you define those terms for us? What do those skills really look like for neurodivergent teens and for their parents?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking that question, because that's part of the main work that I do with parents. There are really four vital skills that I like to teach parents and make sure they have a good foundation to work with when they go home. And those four skills are 1, emotion regulation, 2, radical openness, 3, mental flexibility, and 4, healthy communication for healthy relationships. And so these are really foundational skills that not only is the teen or kid, right, learning in therapy, but if they go home and they're not in that same skill set, it's going to kind of go out the window. So 1 is emotion regulation, right? If the parent doesn't learn themselves how to emotionally regulate or have the skills to be able to kind of take a step back, self-regulate, and there's a lot of specific skills that you can learn. I'm trying not to use too much clinical language or acronyms, but a lot of skills from what we call DBT therapy can be very effective, very helpful. So learning emotion regulation at home when we feel that push and pull. A lot of times for parents, it's kind of you're getting into that argument, you're feeling that push, you're getting sucked in. But I really, right, teaching parents how to kind of just let go of the rope, not get into that push and pull, because it's going to be way more effective when you regulate to then come back and, you know, get a good interaction or a good outcome. So emotion regulation is huge.
You know, I always say a calm brain calms a brain.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more, right? A calm brain is going to just be way more effective and create a much healthier environment. And I know it's really difficult, right? Especially when there's like a time crunch or a lot of pressure, and you're getting pressure from teachers and, you know, other people being like, why isn't your kid doing this, or you're doing a bad job? But it's really for parents learning also skills of like self-compassion, maybe mm-hmm. working with their own therapist to know, okay, this is not the same situation. These expectations are a little bit not my choice and out of my control, but I'm doing the best I can. So emotion regulation, self-compassion is a whole other topic, but I love to talk about self-compassion. But the other skill I'm also teaching parents is radical openness. Mm. And that's what we're really trying to teach the teen in therapy too, is like learning how to be open to doing things differently, trying something new. And a part of that being open, right, is kind of learning how to be vulnerable and learning that it's okay and it's safe to make mistakes. So it's really, right, if the parent can practice that and be very verbal and open about when they're making mistakes, or if they're feeling kind of shame or embarrassment, or they made a mistake, then you're teaching the teen that it's safe to try new things. Mm-hmm. It's safe to make mistakes. It's safe to learn. And so then you'll kind of create an environment where a teen feels safe to then share and try new things without fear of failure or rejection. So openness and willingness to question one's own belief system or thoughts. So the third vital skill, it's called mental flexibility. Mm-hmm. And I just want to preface, these are all components that are taken from a type of therapy called RODBT, Radically Open Dialectical Behavioral Therapy. And it's really, it's to help individuals who kind of deal with more of that kind of over control. So autism, PDA, and, you know, sometimes OCD, and those are side quests. But so with mental flexibility, it's really, it's one's ability to adapt behavior and kind of thought process to what the environment calls for. So if we're getting feedback, right, we're learning how to be radically open to that feedback and allowing ourselves to experience a little bit of the emotions of shame or rejection that one might feel, because it's human and it's okay to feel. But then it's also being willing to adapt, right? And it depends on one's values, right? If maintaining a relationship is really important to someone, then it makes sense that we would be mentally flexible to maintain that relationship. So if that involves getting out of the house, right, seeing friends, going to a new restaurant if that's where friends want to go, brushing teeth if, you know, that's required for health and well-being. So it's responding flexibly when the environment calls for it.
And I'm so glad that you brought up shame. If it looks like I'm about to ask a question, it's because my wheels are just spinning. This is such a rich conversation. Thank you, Sarah, for being here. You mentioned shame. Where does that play into a neurodivergent teen understanding of themselves or even how they fit in social groups?
Oh, my God. Like, this is its own conversation because it's so prolific. It's just, yeah. It's hard not to take it on as a like core belief or core thought process that neurodivergent individuals often develop through childhood, right, to adulthood. And so a lot of individuals are getting diagnosed later in life and having to deal with the shame of it now. But yeah, we're constantly being compared to what is normal or typical, right, at school, in the workplace. Right, they may be often bullied, but there is this kind of constant communication of like, you're not doing it well enough or good enough. And so that shame, right, and also we're like, it is really kind of like lives in the body. And two, at home, and how kind of parents play a role unknowingly, right, is kind of like that communicating with kind of like that frustration of like, why can't you get it? Or why can't you remember? And so it's kind of like then that narrative starts to develop. And maybe the parent, right, has gone through some like intergenerational trauma where they're constantly living in shame and thought process of not being good enough. So now you have two people in the house that's like, I'm failing and not good enough. And that becomes kind of a core part of how they operate in the world. So it's really important that, you know, both individuals are getting their own help and kind of untangling those core beliefs and thought processes. Because, right, that's part of creating like resilient families and resilient individuals is being like, oh, being able to label it. I know, right? I notice I'm having a lot of shame here, or I'm feeling very vulnerable here, or embarrassed. And for a parent to be able to verbalize that to a teen is then, you know, teaching healthier coping, healthier understanding, so that they don't have to live in that shame, and they're more likely to kind of take risks and do new things and take care of themselves.
If you're a parent or caregiver and want to suggest a topic you'd like for me to focus on the show, please email me at growingupwithdr.sarah@gmail.com or send me a voice memo and I'll play it on the show. And please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a comment in this episode if it speaks to you. I will tell you that I'm a great aunt to my nephew who has autism. And I remember his mom telling me he's going to play baseball. And he was so excited about it. And he's 13. And here I am thinking, I just want to protect him. Like, is he going to be able to manage all the rules and not, maybe not even being able to be as athletic? Or, you know, how will he feel when he hits the ball or doesn't hit the ball? And so as we've discussed, that neurodivergence can present in such a huge range. And I was so proud of my niece for letting him play, and he loved it. You brought up such an important point, and that is about how parents can take care of themselves and how parents can also support from afar when a child has severe autism like that. So let's start by just saying, what can parents do? Like, for example, my niece did a beautiful job to really help their teen be involved and not be afraid, but also help the parent not feel that shame or that feeling of, I don't want them to fail.
Totally. Yeah. And like a lot of parents struggle with this, right? Often there's two parents that's kind of like on opposite spent.
Oh, yes.
I remember one is like, I'm like, I don't want them to get hurt. I don't want them to suffer. I want to protect them. Or like, we're being too harsh. And the other is like, no, we're being too lenient, too soft.
Right.
And that's kind of like, yeah, that dichotomy. But for parents, it's, again, I'm always going to come back to like learning self-compassion skills,
mm-hmm.
kind of emotion regulation too, to learn to sit with discomfort too, right? Because often that discomfort with discomfort is then kind of communicated to the teen, where the teen doesn't feel comfortable taking risks. So it's really working with that self-compassion to be like, there's a lot of vulnerabilities here that are leading me to be anxious and worried about, you know, my teen getting hurt or, you know, being bullied or doing it wrong. But it's learning for parents, learning where that urgency is coming from, that urgency to kind of like fix, and learning to kind of sit with that discomfort a bit. Also, just want to stress the important, it's so impossible, it feels impossible, but the importance of the parent also having something of their own, mm-hmm. right? Their own hobby or interest, something outside of the family or the home, that can kind of fill their cup a little bit. I think for a lot of parents, it's kind of like that physical, creating a physical distance, something outside of the home, where they can kind of just be themselves and decompress, is really important to prevent burnout for parents. And sometimes, right, in their own therapy, having to work on that thought process of, I can't, if I leave, something bad's going to happen, or I'm the only one that can do these things. So it's kind of sometimes challenging these thought patterns that are really driven by anxiety.
I hear exactly what you're saying. And I would say that even other parents that are listening, those that may not have a neurodivergent child, as you mentioned, there's such a range. We're all a little bit neurodivergent. I know that I could talk about myself, but this isn't about me.
Same.
You also brought up, you mentioned like school and how teachers, school age aides, coaches, counselors, they kind of play a role in the support for an autistic teen. How do you help the parents help those that are also spending a lot of time with our teens?
Oh my gosh, that's a huge conversation in itself. Because, you know, there are a lot of professionals like teachers and counselors that, you know, they're trying their best. They're trying to help as well, but, you know, they're working against systems that make it really, really hard to give like the proper support for the neurodivergent teen. And especially now, schools are like way understaffed and underfunded.
Oh, I know, hard to I know.
Specialized support. But for parents, recommend, right? It's always like advocating, right, for the needs of their child. Sometimes like keeping a record of conversations they're having with support staff at schools, right?
It's a great idea.
If they're not getting like the support that they need, reaching out to other external organizations that help to advocate, like the ADDA Association, ADA, has a lot of great resources and support, or the IOCDF, International OCD Foundation, has a lot of support. You can even get like lower cost referrals for like, you know, lawyers that might also help advocate on the family's behalf for these needs. But I think too, it's having trained staff that are able to recognize when a teen is struggling in school. So, and that's not always the case. We would hope so, but like making sure that the parents can also kind of provide or shed some light and give some insight to the teachers or counselors, whoever's working. And it's always a good idea to have parents get like an official assessment too, to be able to show the school. And then that's just going to get the ball rolling quicker for more support. So I hope that answers your question.
It's
a big topic.
It really is. I think the point to stress is that every one of us, whether it's in school, the support system at home, those like you and I who are healthcare providers, we all play a role. And really kind of knowing what the right hand is doing and the left hand is doing when it comes to your child, specifically with neurodivergence, is so important. But on the note of like a wider support network, I mentioned I'm a great aunt. I'm interested in how siblings, grandparents, and extended families play a role in your practice. I know you focus mostly on assisting parents, but I imagine that sibling dynamics come up frequently throughout your coaching and conversations. How can parents of multiple children encourage their neurotypical kids to support their siblings who might be struggling?
Oh, that's a good question. Honestly, I've never been asked that question before, so that's a really good question. Yeah, siblings, of course, play a role. And, you know, it also depends on age, level of understanding.
True.
And I always do family session. It's, like, very important to do at least one family educational session where you're giving the opportunity for extended family, like siblings or aunts or grandparents, to also understand more about the neurodivergence itself and what they can do to kind of help in the process, right? A lot of times in those sessions, family are learning for the first time, like, oh, right, my loved one's brain works a little bit different, right? They process information a little bit differently. So the communication sometimes has to be a little bit different too, right? For instance, like just reminding someone to do something might not, you know, cut it. And it's no wonder I'm feeling really frustrated or I get really angry. So it's kind of also helping them access a little bit more of that compassion, right? Not only for their loved one, but also for themselves and the frustration that they might feel. But it's kind of learning to kind of like acknowledge, okay, there's more at work here than just me. It's not that I'm failing or they're failing. It's that there's a kind of brain differences and a system that just was not designed for this type of learning. And so I'm going to be sometimes a little bit more accommodating or do what I can to support or use language or systems like reminders or daily planners or sometimes a little bit of accommodation to help my loved one succeed.
And I think that support for the other children in the family, regardless of their mental status, is important. Sometimes in my practice, I try to find, well, I actually encourage them to find bonding activities that the whole family can agree on. Yeah. And I've seen that that's been really helpful too.
Totally. Yeah, definitely. Shared activities, special interests, engaging in those shared activities to create that bonding and that connection for sure. Yeah.
As we wrap up, Sarah, I want to think about how this episode might resonate even for parents who don't have neurodivergent teens. What do you think can be learned from your work and experience that applies to all parents, no matter their child's level of neurodiversity?
That's a good question too. I think kind of going back to the beginning and saying, wait, everybody is a little bit neurodivergent, maybe not to the same extent where there's kind of like functional impairments in different areas, but understanding that, like, you know, my thought process or my way of doing things is, it's not the only way, and kind of understanding where that kind of rigidity is coming from, and learning how to be a little bit more open to doing things differently or thinking about a problem or a situation differently, and allowing ourselves to kind of let go of that control. It's scary, yes. Right? Especially for parents. Like, no, I don't want them to get hurt. I want them to do it right. And I want them to make a mistake. But like allowing for that discomfort to happen and being able to kind of sit with that discomfort. And that way we can actually experiment and see, right? Did the bad thing happen? Can we get through it? Mm-hmm. Right? And by doing that, we're forming new neural pathways that are like, you know, I can do something different, or I can allow my teen to kind of do it differently, and you know, it will be okay. So go ahead.
And you mentioned how communication is really important. So letting your child do something a little bit differently, taking risks and communicating about it. How did that work? Communicate with your partner if there is one, or communicating with the teen about how they felt about something that you tried, whether it was for the teen alone or as a family.
Yeah, communication, right? That's a core component. That's a vital skill, because the relationship is the most important. I think all partnerships, family members, marriages, any with your boss, like, you know, letting go of the need to be right, mm-hmm. or the facts, and more prioritizing the emotional, that the other person, that each other are emotionally supported. So being able to validate emotions before you kind of jump in to fix or correct is vital for healthy relationships.
Completely agree. One of the reasons I have this podcast is that I want to help parents. And taking care of themselves has a ripple effect on taking care of their children. What are some quick tips for how parents can take care of themselves throughout this process as they're learning with their children?
Okay, quick tips.
You mentioned the one about having a hobby or activity. What are some others?
I'm going to reemphasize this, letting go of the rope, letting go of control. When you feel that push or pull to argue, or like, you're not listening to me, right? It feels very, very urgent, like life or death, because that's what anxiety does.
Yes.
But it's really not life or death. So kind of just, and communicating clearly, because you're demonstrating to the teen how to do this, how to regulate, communicating. I notice that I'm feeling really overwhelmed or really anxious and worried about this. I'm going to go take 10 or 15 minutes to self-regulate, and then I'll come back. Or even giving the option of like, would you like to, I'm going to do some deep breathing, or I'm going to go splash some cold water on my face, or I'm going to go for a walk. Do you want to join? Or doing it separately and then coming back to have the conversation. So I know it's so hard because in the moment that pull is so strong, but being able to let go of the rope, not act with the urgency, put your own oxygen mask on, and then you'll come back to the conversation and it will be way more effective. And therapy, right? Parents, like,
of course,
please, it's totally recommended that you work with someone on your own kind of, sometimes we call thought distortions, how you're viewing or perceiving what's happening in the family or the interactions with the teen, kind of unraveling, you know, where those fears are coming from, and, you know, learning regulation tools from, like, a coach like me or another therapist, you know. And then, too, if you're in a couple, making time for date night, you know, it's specific to each individual, but I think some of the core components remain the same.
Yes, and I love that example of when we model, our kids learn from that too. So not only are we helping ourselves, we're helping our children as well. Sarah, thank you so much for your insight and expertise today.
Of course. No, my pleasure, truly. Thank you so much for having me and providing this as a resource to the community. It's very needed. So thank you for what you do too.
To our listeners at home, I really hope this episode expanded your understanding of your teenager and provided some useful tips for supporting neurodivergent communities. Check out Sarah Morales's work in the show notes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, and let's grow up together.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.